Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Friday, March 12th, 2021. Section A. Midlander calls for legislature to pass Daniel's Law. Legislation would prevent people with special needs from being discriminated against when needing organ transplants. By J.C. Lewis, jacy.lewis@hurstnp.com. A Midlander has become an advocate for those with special needs to be able to receive life-saving organ transplants. Kathleen Kerwin's Haney's brother, Daniel, was denied testing to be put on a donor's list for a kidney because he had Down syndrome. Daniel died at the age of 46 from renal failure. House Bill 119 basically prevents discrimination when it comes to special needs, individuals, and organ transplants, she said. My brother wasn't able to be put on an organ transplant list because he had Down syndrome. Daniel was a lover of life. He was a joyful person. He always greeted everybody with a smile and a hug. One thing that sticks out to me is that he always loved birthdays and celebrations. He would look at the calendar and see whose birthday was coming up. Daniel volunteered at a nursing home 5 days a week for more than 20 years. He and his father, John, enjoyed exercising, whether that was with Daniel running more than a mile on the path around Fascom Park or shooting hoops at the Central Midland Park. He struggled with being shorter, but he practiced until he perfected shooting baskets. We wound up counting 40 to 50 shots in a row. Daniel's health started to decline around 1997. It was around then that the family learned of his kidney problems. My parents took him to a doctor and found that he had kidney damage caused by medication. They took him to a renowned clinic in Texas, and he went there for a couple of years while taking medication for his kidneys. 2 years later, Daniel was admitted to the hospital, and he almost died due to a treatment that was 40 years outdated. The doctors told the family that his damaged kidneys could have been prevented if he was treated correctly. At that point, their parents started giving him catheters for 12 years to keep him off dialysis. Because of the kidney damage, he was on a strict diet. He always loved Diet Coke and hamburgers, but he couldn't enjoy that anymore. The time for dialysis finally came. Dialysis is hard on anybody, but on somebody who has special needs that doesn't understand why they have to do it, it is very difficult. He was nonverbal, so he couldn't say that this is hurting me or I don't feel well today. A lot of the medical community had to guess, and oftentimes people don't listen to people with special needs. Speech isn't the only way to communicate. At that time, their mother, Carolyn, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Their parents were having a hard time keeping up with the care needed. Haney started working as the development director at Senior Life Midland around the same time after signing her parents up for Meals on Wheels and finding out more about the organization. When Daniel went to the Fresenius Kidney Care Permian Basin behind Senior Life Midland, his caregivers would ask Haney to sit in with Daniel during treatments. I would go over and sit with him and hold his hands, she said, but as time went on, it was just too much for him and he didn't want to do it anymore. The family was then told by officials at the dialysis center that Daniel had about a week to live. He lived 5 more months, and in those 5 months he was joyful and happy. I have 2 brothers and a sister, and we worked together, but it was a crisis level almost every day. Daniel died in 2015, the day after Easter. It was so hard because otherwise he was so healthy. He had a very healthy diet and regular exercise. My parents took him to the doctor very regularly. He was in good health other than his kidneys, which went bad because of a medication. His family asked if a transplant was a possibility, but they were told no by different doctors. My parents were older at that point, but they advocated and did their best to make sure Daniel got the best care. There's a point where the system really needs to be working for these special needs individuals, and I can't stress enough, advocating for your own loved ones is imperative. His siblings asked the doctor treating Daniel if they could be tested to see if they were a match, but Daniel was never even tested to be put on a donor's list. We would ask, why can't he get a transplant? He's healthy otherwise. They would reply, he has Down syndrome, so he can't. That response did not sit well with Haney then, and it doesn't sit well with her now. She has teamed up with State Representative Brooks Landgraf of Odessa and started working on Daniel's Law last year. People with special needs can be excluded from donors' lists because there are no protections for people with special needs in Texas currently. At the time, we all didn't think it was right, but we didn't really know that there was something we could do, which is advocating. It is inhumane, and it is unethical treatment. He was a good person, and he mattered. She went to Austin on Wednesday to testify for the bill at the Texas House of Representatives, Public Health Committee, Daniel's Law, House Bill 119, and Senate Bill 1017, have been filed for the 87th legislature session. It was an amazing opportunity to talk about how wonderful my brother was. It was also imperative that I get the point across to them that this inequality and injustice are just devastating, as well as life-ending for someone like my brother. While she was in Austin, community members reached out via text messages and Facebook Messenger with messages of support. It feels really good to have this support and know the community that my mom and dad loved dearly and Daniel was such an important part of is still embracing them long after they're gone. Jenny Cudd requests venue change, separate trial from Elio Rosa by Caitlin Randall, CRANDLE at MRT.com. Jenny Cudd has filed motions to sever her case from co-defendant Elio Rosa and move her trial to West Texas, citing prejudice from the potential jury pool in Washington, D.C. Cudd and Rosa are each charged with obstruction of an official proceeding, entering a restricted building, disruptive conduct in a restricted building, disorderly conduct in a Capitol building, and parading, demonstrating, or picketing in a Capitol building. They're facing up to 20 years in prison for the obstruction charge, a felony, as well as up to 3 years in prison for the misdemeanor charges. In a motion filed Wednesday, Cudd's attorney, Marina Medvin, argues the prosecution is attempting to create the appearance of a conspiracy by joining the defendant's cases. She notes that neither Cudd nor Rosa have been charged with conspiracy. There is no evidence of communications or a plan between the two to enter the Capitol, Medvin writes in the motion. Instead, the evidence is purported to be that they were at the same place at the same time, followed a crowd into the open doors of the Capitol building, then walked out. Cudd and Rosa traveled to the District of Columbia together and were with each other during protests before the riots, according to posts and videos on their since-deleted Facebook pages. Medvin also states that joining the cases allows the government to enter evidence against Cudd that would not be permitted otherwise. Rosa gave a statement to FBI agents before his arrest, which the prosecution intends to introduce as evidence against Cudd, according to Medvin. This statement would normally not be admissible in a trial of Ms. Cudd without Mr. Rosa taking the stand to testify and give Ms. Cudd an opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Rosa. But if the cases are joined, the statement can be introduced against Mr. Rosa and hence be presented at the trial of Ms. Cudd, without Mr. Rosa needing to take the stand and without Ms. Cudd's counsel having the opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Rosa. Additionally, the defense plans to call on Rosa to testify on Cudd's behalf, which would not be possible in a joint trial. The same day the motion to sever the defendant's cases was filed, Medvin filed a motion to move Cudd's case to the Western District of Texas, claiming Cudd's case will be violated if the case proceeds in D.C. Ms. Cudd asserts that detrimental pretrial publicity and community prejudice in D.C. is so likely to have affected the jury pool that the venue must be presumed as tainted. She states that Cudd's pro-Trump statements would bias a D.C. jury against her, noting that 95% of D.C. voters voted against Donald Trump in the 2020 election, compared to 77% of voters in Midland County, who voted for the former president. Medvin also writes that the presence of 26,000 National Guard troops in D.C. following the Capitol riots and statements by Democratic leaders referring to the events of January 6th as an attempted insurrection and act of domestic terrorism have tainted a potential jury pool. The government objects to both separating the defendants' cases and moving Cudd's trial, according to the motions. A status hearing is scheduled for 10 a.m. Friday. City's sales tax collection drops nearly 20%, by Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HearstMP.com. The city was handed more bad news this month when it came to its sales tax collection. The city reported a 19% decrease in its sales tax collection compared to March 2020. It continues a downward trend over the last 2 years, as the $3.135 million collected was more than 35% lower than that collected in March 2019. March ended the second quarter of the city's fiscal year, and it appears the story was the same. Statistics indicate that the city collected $11.4 million in January through March. This was more than $2 million less than the same period of 2020. There was hope that the 4.5% decrease in February might have been part of a sales tax collection turnaround, but the double-digit percentage increase this month shows the city is not out of the woods yet when it comes to this economic indicator. The city has experienced double-digit percentage declines in 11 of the last 14 months and declines over the past 15 months, according to the Reporter-Telegram. Over the course of this fiscal year, the $23.161 million in sales tax revenue is down 17.6% from last year's total through 6 months. Sales tax revenue is generated by sales tax income from 2 months prior to collection. March collection is based on January sales. The city's fiscal year runs from October through the following September. The city of Odessa reported a 34% sales tax decrease this month. They reported having collected $2.778 million. Things to know about COVID and vaccinations in Midland. The number of vaccines administered is likely going to top 60,000 this week. Through Wednesday, Midland Health reported having provided 58,900, including more than 33,000 at the Horseshoe Complex. Midland Health reported that the percentage of COVID patients compared to total inpatients inside Midland Memorial fell below 10% on Thursday. The 9% number tied a recent low percentage of patients at the MMH. Another positive trend was that 6.3% of people testing for COVID at Midland Health Centers were testing positive. That is slightly higher than the 5.4% testing last week. The city reported that 47 positive cases have been reported this week. Last week, there were 117. The opinion page. Opinion extra. Why Dr. Seuss had to go. This week, Dr. Seuss Enterprises announced it would stop the sale and distribution of 6 classic volumes from the great children's author. Those volumes, said the company, violate its commitment to messages of hope, inspiration, inclusion, and friendship. The books include portrayals of people in ways that are hurtful and wrong. Society has long held that activity that damages others ought to be curbed. John Stuart Mill posited the so-called harm principle, the belief that activity that harms someone ought to be condemned or even barred, in the mid-19th century. But Mill refused to conflate harm and offense. Being offended wasn't cause for sanction of another. Broadly speaking, society agreed with this formulation. But in the past few years, this formulation has been completely turned on its head. Now, offense is not only considered a harm, it is considered the chief harm in our society. Physical injury, after all, is merely physical. But mental or emotional injury that threatens our very sense of identity. Because we find our identity in our own sense of self-creation, any societal denial of that sense threatens our identity. As Carl Truman writes in The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, The era of psychological man therefore requires changes in the culture and its institutions, practice, and beliefs that affect everyone. They all need to adapt to reflect a therapeutic mentality that focuses on the psychological well-being of the individual. When individual self-creation becomes the chief goal of a society, institutions must be torn down. Institutions, after all, foster a set of rules that may not be conducive to individual self-creation. Informational flow must be dammed. After all, information may allow others to take a different, objectively based opinion about you than you take subjectively about yourself. Books must be burned. After all, books carry with them implicit messages that may threaten your sense of yourself. Iconoclasm becomes the order of the day. Our societal turn from actual, measurable harm towards subjective, psychological harm places us on the road to complete devastation of our culture and our rights. Now, anyone who offends, or even has the potential to offend, can be, and indeed ought to be, fired. Now, any book, no matter how old or how inoffensive, can be, and indeed ought to be, banned. Now, any kernel of information, no matter how true, can be discarded. This formulation puts all power in the hands of those who are most easily offended, or at least those who claim to be. The offense itself is the weapon. Legal torts require damages. Societal torts merely require a claim of damages, without evidence. No one can explain just how a drawing in "If I Ran the Zoo" has contributed to actual racism. There are no recorded incidents of a single white supremacist citing "And to think what I saw it on Mulberry Street" as a formative source in his racist worldview. But any academic with a computer and a degree in postmodern nonsense can take those books off the shelves simply by claiming that offense is possible. In the end, the only literature allowed will be the literature which adheres to the values of our postmodern world, a world in which we are not expected to conform to societal rules, but society is expected to conform to our own acts of self-definition. That means your child reading "I Am Jazz," but never, never, Gaia forbid, the Bible. It means goodbye to cultural icons, large and small. Goodbye to all vestiges of the past, replete with their bigoted value systems. It means that the purges have only just begun. Ben Shapiro, Content Creators. Obituaries and Death Notices. Rosa Urias Ray went to her heavenly home on March the 7th. Viewing will be Sunday, March 14th, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. with a rosary at 7 at Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Funeral Mass is scheduled for 12 o'clock Monday, March 15th at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Gardens. Funeral Mass is under the direction of Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin at nts-online.net. Shirley Mason Spencer Barrett passed peacefully on March the 10th. Memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, March 13th at First United Methodist Church in Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.mpwelsh.com. Terry K. Garrison passed from this earth and gained her heavenly wings on Wednesday, March 10th, from complications from frontotemporal dementia. The family will receive friends on Friday, March 12th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Branch at MPW Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held on Saturday, March 13th at 2 p.m. at Midland City's Neely Campus. Private family burial will be held at Rest Haven Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.mpwelsh.com. Thomas R. Simpson, passed into the arms of the Lord on March the 8th. The family will receive guests from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, March 12th at Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, March 13th at Fairmont Park Church of Christ, with interment following at Rest Haven Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelsh.com. Edna Jean Hector of Midland passed away on Thursday, March 4th. Viewing will be held on Saturday, March 13th from 1 to 3 p.m. with a funeral service beginning at 3 p.m. at Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Friday, March 12th, 2021. Section A. Fine Arts Bill Causes a Stir. By Ruth Campbell. A bill that would let students substitute a career and technical education credit for fine arts has been introduced in the Texas legislature. Representative Keith Bell, Republican Forney, filed House Bill 434. It was given a committee hearing March 9th. Representative Brooks Landgraf, Republican Odessa, said he's not sure how much support it has. But my position on that issue is I think CTE, career and technical education, is very important. And I think that we do need to emphasize that more, especially for students who want to have a good career without having to go to college, Landgraf said. But I also know that the fine arts programs are valuable. When you have two important programs like that, I don't think that one should be sacrificed for the other. A spokesman for Bell's office said their feeling for this bill is if we're going to give eighth graders the responsibility to choose the track that they want to go on after eighth grade and continuing on to high school, then these students should be able to choose if they want to participate in a fine arts credit or if they'd like to participate in a CTE course. Students would be able to use their elective credits to continue on in fine arts and have CTE as well. We're not trying to take away from the fine arts or anything like that, the spokesman said. We're just giving the students a choice to whether the students who know that they're probably going to start a career on a career and technical avenue after they graduate high school and know that they don't want to take a fine arts class, they're not interested in fine arts class, and they'd rather take a class in welding or what it might be. These students have the option to do that. Landgraf said he thinks there is room, given the number of electives that students are allowed to have in Texas, that they could take a credit in one of each. That would be my approach, but I guess the important thing for me is that we not sacrifice one good program for another one, Landgraf said. He added that the bill has gotten a lot of attention, and he has heard from some of his own former teachers in Ector County ISD. I've been happy to visit with quite a few constituents about it. It's always good to hear from people who had such a big impact on my life, but it's certainly part of the equation. I understand the value, and that's why I don't think that we should forsake either program. If anything, we should be emphasizing both, he said. He noted that not every high school freshman knows what path they want to take. But being able to get some experience in both may help them decide which path is best for them. That's why I think it's important for us to emphasize and promote both, because I think that's what's best for students. Director of Fine Arts Aaron Hawley said it gives fine arts an opportunity to just re-emphasize the impact that fine arts has on students' lives. Through this, we'll be able to demonstrate that fine arts helps develop creativity and builds confidence. Oftentimes, it helps them work with others, sometimes diverse people. It develops critical thinking skills. When things focus on, especially legislation focuses on fine arts, it's just an opportunity for us to emphasize how important it is for art to be in all our lives, not just kids' lives, but all our lives. I think you'll see that. I think you'll notice across the state that art is very important to the state of Texas and to our kids, Holly said. In ECISD, Holly said students can take both fine arts and career and technical education. All of our students currently take fine arts, and then they all have the ability to take CTE. We want the kids to do the things that they want to do, but also, as the director of fine arts, I believe that the arts help develop well-rounded individuals. I personally believe that all students should have the opportunity to be in fine arts, he said. Holly noted that ECISD has arts available at the elementary, middle, and high school levels. We want our kids to have options, and I think that's going to continue. Our kids are going to be in fine arts. Our kids are going to be in athletics. Our kids are going to be in CTE, and that's just to name a few of them. Many times, that's what brings the kids to the school. That's what keeps them engaged. Sometimes we are the motivating factor that determines whether or not they succeed, he added. Volunteers Return to Medical Center by Michael Bauer. For the first time in almost a year, Medical Center Hospital volunteers were allowed to come back. Last year, with the outbreak of the COVID-19 virus, MCH was unable to keep volunteers inside the hospital due to safety. However, with cases going down and people continuing to get vaccinated, the volunteer workers were able to return. It's been a long year, MCH manager of volunteers Jennifer Jones said. I knew that the volunteers were wanting to come back as soon as they could. We had to wait until it was safe. Our administration had to wait until it was safe for the volunteers to come back. Jones added that they are still starting off slowly, as they want to take as many safety precautions as possible to keep everyone well as they gradually get back into the swing of things. As we evaluate weekly, we'll see how the numbers are and if we're able to open up more, Jones said. Right now, they have 55 adult volunteers. In 2019, we had 89 junior volunteers, Jones said. I don't know when or if it'll start up for junior volunteers. Right now, we're starting off slowly. We want to be safe and we'll reevaluate as it comes along and as time comes. But we have to be safe. Safety is going to be the priority. As far as numbers go, Jones isn't sure if all the volunteers have returned. We'd like for them to be back, but then we'd need a place to put them to come back, Jones said. A lot of details need to be worked out for them to come back. It depends on their personal safety issues, and they'd have to follow the guidelines to come back. I can't predict if it'll be 100%, but I'd like it to be around 90%. Volunteers tend to stick around. Once they're happy, they'll keep coming back. Jones added that volunteers have to sign a waiver that they understand the risks involved and have to be vaccinated. The requirement is that they need to have their COVID shots or their antibody tests, Jones said, because they're coming in willingly. They're not employed. They're volunteers. That's going to be a requirement. It's for their safety. The volunteer roles have also changed. In the past, their jobs varied from delivering flowers to patients to help delivering mail to hunting down a wheelchair and taking people to places around the building. Due to safety precautions, the volunteers are limited to working on the first floor, where helping run the front desk, running the popcorn stand, and helping greet people. Right now, the volunteers don't have quite the freedom that they had within the building, Jones said. We want to keep them safe. Their roles are going to be pretty simple. As time goes on, we'll expand those rules. But even something as simple as delivering flowers, that would require them to go upstairs, and that's one area they can't go to. Delivering mail, we cannot have them go and do that. Jones said that could change in a week or two, but it's still very much up in the air. We just don't know, Jones said. It depends on how safe we are in Odessa. Despite what the nation is doing, we have to be safe here at Medical Center. Among the volunteers back at MCH is Gracie Sanchez, who's been working as a volunteer there since 2017 and is a longtime Odessa resident. "It feels good to be back," Jones said. "It's like coming back to work after one full year. You get to see your friends. You get to see being around other people and helping others." During 1 year hiatus, Jones and her other volunteers were able to keep busy as they worked on other projects outside of the hospital, such as painting kindness messages on rocks that were distributed to the nurses at MCH during National Nurses Week last year. "There was a lot of cooking at home," Jones said. "We've had a lot of projects going on. Even though we couldn't come to the hospital, we could do things to keep us entertained and keep in touch with people that we worked with at the hospital." Other projects outside of the hospital included bunnies for Easter and Christmas angels, as well as drive-by birthdays for some of the employees, according to Jones. Linda Golden, who volunteers with her husband Phil, were also glad to be back at MCH this week. "It's wonderful," Linda said. "We have missed being here so much. We missed other people. We missed the staff and other volunteers and everyone else." Unlike some of the volunteers, Linda and Phil's job hasn't changed since before the pandemic, as they resumed their duties running the popcorn stand just as they had before. "My husband pops the popcorn, and I do the transactions and give the drinks and pickles," Linda said. "We've got the same routine that we've had before, coming in the morning and getting the machine popping." Both Linda and Phil, who have volunteered at MCH for 4 years now and are both retired, have a lot of fun running the machine. "It's a fairly simple routine," Phil said. "If we take care of the machine, it'll take care of us. Proper maintenance is important, but it's a lot of fun. We do it once or twice every 2 weeks, and it gives us something to do and makes us feel useful." "The past year has been tough," according to Linda. "Isolation is very difficult," she said, "not just for us as volunteers, but everyone. Our whole community has been isolated for a year. It's exhilarating to be out of that and back into the community." Ann Ellison, another longtime Odessan, has been volunteering at MCH since 2015 and enjoys being able to talk with others. "I just like the interaction with people," Ellison said. "My husband and I had our own photography business, and we were active all the time. It's nice to be back. We have great volunteers and management." The schedules that the volunteers work is also different than in the past, as the hospital looks to gradually expand on that as the weeks come. "Right now, this week, we just opened up on Tuesday and Wednesday," Jones said. "They'll evaluate how safe that is, and then we'll expand as time goes by. That will be at the advice of our administration staff, whenever they think it's safe for Odessa to have more volunteers in the building." Jones also added that the employees at MCH have been overjoyed to have the volunteers back as well. "It means a lot to them," Jones said. "I'm not sure who was more excited to have them back, the staff or the volunteers themselves, but it's been like school starting up. There's been excitement." As for those who are interested in volunteering, Jones says they're still looking for people to help out. "We're always looking for volunteers," Jones said. "There's an application process and an onboarding process, but if someone is interested, they can call my office at 432-640-2249. Volunteering is giving, and I think people need to give back because the return will make their own life better." Innovation Department seeks OHS Observatory memories by Ruth Campbell. If all goes well, Odessa High School could reopen its rediscovered observatory later this year. Ector County ISD Chief Innovation Officer Jason Osborne said an email was sent about the observatory, which has been around since 1969. Innovation Instructional Specialist Mary Fulton said they found out about the observatory in November, and work started soon after. We scheduled some time to go over there and check out the observatory, and lo and behold, there were two really old telescopes that were still in place and still pointed up towards the sky, just as though they were just placed there, Osborne said. They were in really good shape, and the roof retracted away so you had an open view to the sky, and we were just amazed, so that built some excitement that OHS has this gem of an observatory that we felt we had to spend some time and some attention to get it back in order for kids to have the opportunity to get involved with hands-on science. He noted that everything was in working order. A spiral staircase takes you up to a platform, and there is a switch on the wall that you flip, and the roof retracts. So there's a section of the roof that actually opens up to the sky. The fact that they thought of this and thought of putting this up there in 1969 is absolutely fascinating. There was a great movement for space exploration. We're very interested in seeing who out there in the community is willing to come forward and talk about their experiences about being a student or an educator at that time and share some insight of what that was like. We'd love to learn from the public, Osborne said. If anyone wants to share their experiences from the OHS Observatory, they can contact Fulton at mary.fulton@ectorcountyisd.org. Parts were ordered to make repairs, and the West Texas Astronomers Club is offering advice on how to best make those fixes and see what is needed. A new state-of-the-art telescope was ordered to go up on that platform. That way, students can look at the old technology versus new technology and look at the night sky, Osborne said. That's all been a part of the PIC Education Chevron grant that covered the cost of the renovations and the new telescopes. We were hoping we would have it ready by the spring and then have a re-grand opening of the observatory. Fulton said the cost of equipment and repairs came to about $15,000. We'll also have cameras that will attach to the old telescopes so students can download images to their iPads or their phones as well, Fulton said. The two older telescopes will also be able to be used in ways they weren't in 69. Osborne said this is a wonderful opportunity for students and ties in with the SpaceX technology that will be piloted in Pleasant Farms to bring high-speed internet to that area. We are looking at doing the student space flight experiments this year. Again, that would be a SpaceX rocket shooting up student experiments with the Mars rover landing and with the observatory, he added. OHS also is looking to add a 21-foot-tall inflatable planetarium where up to 100 students at a time can look at the night sky. It will all be interactive, Osborne said, and have a lot of different crossovers into many course areas. All this will go together really nicely into a really cool opportunity. And then outside of that, we are gaining a ton of interest from UTPB to also collaborate with us on the astronomy tie and partner, Osborne added. They currently do not have an observatory, so we can envision them partnering with us and coming over and using the observatory, and then creating natural pathways for students to go into UTPB. We have been in communication with Dr. Michael Zavada at UTPB about this. He's extremely excited and very ambitious to partner. We've already partnered with him to grow a geoscience program, which was new this past year. And now we're looking at opportunities to possibly create a dual credit astronomy course, Osborne said. Zavada is professor and chair of the Department of Geosciences at UTPB. Quick hits. Meeting. Comanche Trails Wood Turners has scheduled a meeting from 10 a.m. to noon Saturday at George Hancock's shop, 1709 Clark in Midland. Coulter Allison will demonstrate the basics of bowl turning on the wood lathe. The public is welcome to all our demonstrations. For more information, call 432-439-5343. Aviation Fun Day. The CAF High Sky Wing, CAF Desert Squadron, and West Texas Aviators has scheduled Aviation Fun Day from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturday at High Sky Wing, 9600 Wright Drive in Midland. There will be open cockpit tours, museum tours, aircraft rides, a fly-in day, and reenactors. Lunch and drinks will be available for purchase. Admission is free. Visit tinyurl.com/Y675J7CT. Trade Days. Andrews Trade Days has been scheduled from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Saturday at the James Roberts Center, 855 East Texas 176 in Andrews. There will be garden decor, jewelry, floral designs, woodcrafts, art, candles, wreaths, gourmet foods, boutique clothing, fashionable accessories, unique gifts, food trucks, and more. Visit tinyurl.com/VKXY8ZSW. West Texas Celtic Fair. West Texas Celtic Fair has been scheduled for March 13th and 14th at the Midland County Horseshoe Arena Pavilion Amphitheater, 2514 Arena Trail in Midland. Hours will be from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Saturday and 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Sunday. There will be workshops, classes, events, beer and whiskey tasting, Bonniest Knees Contest, Scottish Gaelic language classes, and more. Visit tinyurl.com/RMY5MYCD. City of Odessa Municipal Court receives Traffic Safety Award. The City of Odessa Municipal Court recently received a Traffic Safety Award from the Texas Municipal Courts Education Center in connection with TxDOT, according to a city press release. TMCEC's Municipal Traffic Safety Initiative's purpose is to prevent impaired driving through Texas Municipal Courts. This is achieved by offering impaired driving courses at judicial education seminars and through webinars, distributing free anti-DUI and DWI books and materials, and recognizing as models those municipal courts that demonstrate excellence in impaired driving prevention. The Odessa Municipal Court, in collaboration with the Odessa Fire Rescue Fire Marshals Division, hosted a Child Safety Seat Expo during Child Passenger Safety Week, September 20th through 26th. Three certified child safety seat technicians were on site to inspect child passenger safety systems for attendees to determine whether they were in good working order and if they were installed correctly. If it was determined that the installation was incorrect, the technicians reinstalled them correctly while providing education and guidance on correct installation techniques and other safety tips for traveling with children. If it was determined that the attendee's child passenger safety system was not in good working order, they were gifted with a new car seat or safety system appropriate for the attendee's child's age and or size. The municipal court also provided copies of the Bernard in the Backseat booklet, courtesy of TxDOT through TMCEC, for children attending the expo with their parents. Local News Roundup. Police searching for man connected to auto burglary. The Odessa Police Department is looking for a man involved in an auto burglary. The reported burglary happened at 1:30 a.m. February 16th in the 2400 block of West 34th an OPD press release stated. Investigation reportedly showed that a man burglarized a 2018 Ford F-150 and stole $1,030 worth of property. The man fled the scene in a white four-door pickup. OPD has released a photo of the man that can be seen at tinyurl.com/5VFCKUE4. Anyone with information about the auto burglary is asked to contact Detective A. Munoz at 432-335-4964 or Odessa Crime Stoppers at 432-333-TIPS and reference case number 21-0002639. Man charged with assaulting man with hammer. A 43-year-old man was arrested after he reportedly assaulted his mother's common-law husband with a hammer. Deborick Anderson was charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, causing serious bodily injury, family violence, a second-degree felony. The reported assault happened March 10th in the 300 block of Bunch Avenue, an OPD probable cause affidavit detailed. Officers reportedly arrived at the scene to find Anderson and the victim, identified as Zachary Jackson. Anderson and Jackson both reside in the same residence in the 300 block of Bunch, as Jackson is the common law husband to Anderson's mother, identified as Sandra Anderson. Investigation showed that Jackson had left the residence in the 300 block of Bunch and went to a residence in the 200 block of Carver prior to the assault, the affidavit stated. Anderson stated that he walked over to where Jackson was on Carver Avenue with a hammer in his pants pocket to try to talk to Jackson about an earlier argument. Anderson reportedly detailed to police that Jackson bowed up to him and got into a fighting stance, at which time Anderson threw the first punch that started the fight. Jackson stated that Anderson came over to where he was on Carver Avenue and just began to physically assault him with a hammer. Officers saw bumps on the left side of Jackson's head that could be consistent with being struck by a hammer. Officers reportedly found the hammer outside the residence close to where Anderson was sitting outside when police arrived. Anderson was arrested, charged, and transported to the Ector County Law Enforcement Center. Bond had not been set as of Thursday afternoon, jail records show. Sales tax drops for March. The city of Odessa received its March sales tax check in the amount of $3,473,311.98, which includes the economic development sales tax of a quarter of a cent. The city of Odessa will receive $2,778,649.58, and Odessa Development Corporation will receive $694,662.40. Medical Care Hospital will receive $2,721,819, according to a press release. The city saw a decrease in sales tax revenue, with March's sales tax revenue total of $2,778,649.58, which reflects a $1,424,844.08 or 33.9% decrease compared to March 2020. The year-to-date total sales tax revenue for fiscal year 2020-21 is up 17.13% or $2,920,516.32 as compared to budgeted amount expected at this point in the fiscal year. The 2020-21 year-to-date amount is below the previous fiscal year-to-date amount by $6,888,639.60, or 25.65%. The city has budgeted $36 million in net sales tax revenues for this current fiscal year. Sales tax revenue is generated by sales tax revenue from 2 months prior to collection. March's collection is based on January sales. Obituary for Friday, March 12th. Thomas C. Sosa, Jr. Thomas Coleman Sosa, Jr., 69, of Odessa, passed away February 18th. He was called Tomito or Mito or Tomas by families. Thomas was born July 27, 1951, in Big Spring to Thomas Coleman Sosa Sr. and Diamantina Sanchez Sosa. He was preceded in death by his parents, one brother, Estanislao, one sister, Rosemary. Thomas is survived by his three sisters, Cynthia S. Vasquez, Norma Sosa, Mary Catherine Katie Sosa, Olivia Carolyn Sosa, and a brother, Alexander Sosa. Funeral service will be at Iglesia Agua Viva, March 13th at 1 p.m. An interment of ashes, mass, rosary, and ceremony at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church will be held March 13th, Saturday afternoon. In lieu of flowers, donations in his memory may be made to Iglesia Agua Viva or St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church. Arrangements are entrusted to La Paz Purchase Funeral Home. Death notices. Estelle Irene Oglesby Havis. Estelle Irene Oglesby Havis, 98, of Odessa, died Thursday, March 4th. A graveside service was held Thursday, March 11th at Fairview Cemetery in Pecos. Arrangements by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Rosalba Castillo Romero. Rosalba Castillo Rosie Romero, 42, of Odessa, died Sunday, March 7th. Mass will be celebrated at 10 a.m. Saturday, March 13th at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Ali M. Sierra Rodriguez. Ali M. Sierra Rodriguez, 26, of Odessa, died Sunday, March 7th. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Jimmy Leroy Smith. Jimmy Leroy Smith, 81, of Odessa, died Tuesday, March 9th. Private graveside services will be held at 10 a.m., March 12th, at Sunset Memorial Gardens, with Reverend Chris Hager officiating. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, March 3rd, 2021. This article is entitled API Mull's Embrace of Carbon Pricing by Jennifer A. DeLuey, Bloomberg. The American Petroleum Institute is considering throwing its weight behind a government-imposed price on carbon dioxide emissions as a way to show global warming, a major policy shift by the oil industry's top trade group. API's draft policy statement does not endorse a specific mechanism, such as a tax on carbon dioxide emissions or a cap-and-trade system, but endorses what it calls a market-based, economy-wide policy, according to two people familiar with the discussions. It could receive a vote by the group's executive board later this week. Proponents argue that a carbon tax that increases the cost of energy derived from oil, natural gas, and coal could be more effective than regulations at pairing U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. Such a tax, the proceeds of which could be rebated to consumers, would discourage the use of fossil fuels while encouraging the market to develop low-carbon alternatives. The Chamber of Commerce embraced market-based policies to limit emissions in January, and several of API's largest members, including ExxonMobil Group, ConocoPhillips, BP PLC, and Royal Dutch Shell PLC, already support a carbon tax and rebate program. Getting a market price on carbon is going to be really important to make sure that we're using market forces to try most cost-effectively to reduce CO2 emissions. Exxon's Chief Executive Officer, ExxonMobil Chief Executive Officer Darren Woods said at the CERA Week by IHS Market Conference Tuesday, "Governments should not pick winners and losers." The efforts have gained momentum as international energy companies are making investment decisions based on the assumption that emission limits will be imposed by regulation, tax, or other mechanisms. The companies are seeking regulatory certainty on the issue instead of environmental policies that whipsaw with every presidential election. And they are bracing for possible tariffs on imports from countries with lax climate policies, a potential risk for U.S. companies selling carbon-intensive products globally. API previously telegraphed its support in January when it said it supported the ambitions of the Paris Agreement to pair greenhouse gas emissions and cited, quote, market-based policies, unquote, such as carbon pricing, as a way to balance those reductions with flexibility and pacing to keep energy affordable. API Senior Vice President of Communications Megan Blumgren said the group has convened top energy officials throughout the supply chain to incubate a host of policy solutions and industry actions to shape a lower carbon future. "Our efforts are focused on supporting a new U.S. contribution to the Global Paris Agreement," Blumgren said by email. Consideration of API's move was earlier reported by the Wall Street Journal. Some environmentalists who oppose fossil fuel development criticized the possible move, with Maya Golden-Krasner, deputy director of the Center for Biological Diversity's Climate Law Institute, calling it, quote, little more than a public relations ploy, unquote. "Instead of letting producers buy their way out of climate accountability, we need strong regulations to keep fossil fuels in the ground," Golden-Krasner said. The effort divides the oil and gas industry. Some large integrated energy companies that have global operations and investments in low-carbon businesses favor the approach. Many independent oil producers and refiners are opposed. Natural gas. A carbon tax could benefit producers of natural gas over coal and spur investment in renewables and nuclear power. Several utilities have lobbied Biden administration officials to support a nationwide carbon price. And Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who previously endorsed a carbon tax as the textbook solution to climate change, reiterated in January that effective carbon pricing is essential to solve the climate crisis. "I am fully supportive of effective carbon pricing, and I know that the president is as well," Yellen said in written answers to Senate Finance Committee questions. Nevertheless, the politics of the issue are challenging, particularly in the Senate, which voted 50-50 along party lines last month to block a measure that would have opposed a carbon tax. Senator Joe Manchin, whose role representing coal-rich West Virginia and heading the Chamber's Energy Committee makes him a key Democratic vote on such issues, signaled his openness to carbon pricing by voting with his party on the measure. Several Republicans, including Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Mitt Romney of Utah, have said they are open to a carbon tax. But developing a consensus plan has proved difficult, with an array of proposals advanced on Capitol Hill in recent years. Some initiatives have lured Republican and business support by imposing a carbon tax in exchange for wiping away federal regulation of carbon dioxide emissions, a trade-off many environmentalists staunchly oppose. Still, other thorny questions surround how carbon tax revenue would be used, with some proposals calling for the money to be rebated to American taxpayers, and others pushing for proceeds to go to environmental restoration projects and revitalizing coal communities.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.